Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is Lawrence Lessig, Harvard Law professor, noted legal scholar, and candidate for president in 2016. Glad to have you.
Glad to be here, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Can the legal system save democracy?
Yeah, no. Only the people can save democracy. Legal system is a very poor backup for that.
So knowing that, what would you advise the people to do, or how do we move down that path?
Well, my own view is we have an existential crisis facing us right now with this next election. And it's critical not just to get responsible leadership in the White House, but also to get a Senate that is responsive to the needs of Americans. And if we could get both of those things, then I think the first thing that next Congress needs to do is to take up the challenge of removing the corruption that's at the core of our government. And that's by passing the kind of reform that makes it so that representatives care about what the people want instead of what the tiny fraction of funders of their campaigns want.
Let's start right today. Right as we speak, there's a crisis with the USPS, United States Postal Service. They're going to have hearings. Can hearings make any difference?
Yeah, what we've seen is that there's basically nothing that stops this president. And so as extraordinary as the post office crisis is, I think it's even more astonishing to think what it signals about what's going to come. Because, you know, what the president's doing with the post office is literally incomprehensible. I mean, Jackson, it turns out, President Jackson did something similar way back in the day when he was trying to get Martin Van Buren to be elected after him. But since then, there's been a pretty clear understanding that the infrastructure of the post office is not a political pawn for the president. But here you have a president who has appointed his number one contributor to dismantle the infrastructure of the post office for the purpose of making it harder for somebody to beat him in the next election. Now, of course, the post office is not just a system for delivering ballots. You know, there are people who have medicine, who need that medicine, who will have that medicine delayed because the post office isn't functioning well. I sold two things on eBay. It took 6 weeks for them to be delivered using, you know, the standard parcel post, the standard way it should have taken 4 days. So we are dismantling infrastructure to make it easier for him to be reelected. Now, the idea that he could do that shows there's nothing he won't do. And what terrifies me is that the system we have for electing the president is so fragile. It depends on people of good faith on both sides participating in an election. If you have somebody acting in bad faith, especially with courts as pathetic as our courts have been I'm not sure what happens when he does everything he possibly can to make sure that he gets another 4 years in office.
Let's stop for a second. What is Larry Lessig selling on eBay?
I was selling some used technology. I had an original Apple TV. And then I had from a G3 PowerBook, I had one of those CD drives for the G3 PowerBook, which, you know, got $10 on eBay, but whatever.
Okay, because the remuneration is so low and the effort involved, I wouldn't say is significant, but certainly takes time. Do you appreciate the experience? Why do you take time out as opposed to just leaving this stuff on the shelf for recycling it?
Yeah, you know, my wife, I love my wife. My wife is obsessed about recycling and waste. So, you know, the expense, the time, the hassle in selling is tiny compared to the guilt that I would feel if I tried to get rid of it in the more rational way. So, yeah, I try to sell it. Now, you know, some of these things like, you know, the CD for a G3 PowerBook, there are not many out there. And if you've got a G3 PowerBook, I don't know what you're using it for, but, you know, I'm sure you're happy to have that CD. So, you know, part of me is okay with it.
Okay, staying on that same topic, you know, there have been a lot of articles, even in the New York Times Magazine, that recycling doesn't work. I know this is a little off topic going to your wife, but do you have a take on that?
Yeah, we certainly have not built up a profitable infrastructure for recycling. And, you know, I think there's a real debate. Are we just trying to train people so that when we get to that profitable infrastructure, we can deploy it effectively? Obviously, other countries are much more creative about ways to reduce or to channel waste. You know, in Switzerland, you pay per, I can't remember, it's cubic meter or pound, but whatever. You have this extraordinarily high price you pay for every bag of trash that you might want to get rid of. So it really changes that consumption pattern. And you know, we experiment with what we can here. I've got three kids, so there's a limit to how idealistic we can be about these issues.
Okay, let's go back to the postmaster. Assuming you were advising the Democrats or those in power, what strategy would you employ to try to fix this situation?
Well, I don't know that there is a strategy now. I mean, what frustrated me in March and April is that they didn't use the leverage they had over the response to the COVID crisis to guarantee that we would have the infrastructure necessary to make this election work. Everyone was so obsessed with, like, what do we do in the immediate term? And, of course, in the immediate term, they bent over backwards to make sure businesses and relatively successful people were taken care of. And there was a little bit of a $600 benefit that everybody could take advantage of if they needed it. But they didn't build in the guarantee for vote by mail at the states. And they certainly didn't build in a guarantee that the post office would have the capacity to do what it needs to do. Having not done that, you know, I think the most that they can do now is just to drive people's focus to this fact. Now, that's a hard thing to do in the media environment that we live in right now because, you know, a certain chunk of America is focused on a channel or a couple channels that will never cover any of these issues in a way that reveals or suggests that there's anything problematic with what the president's doing. And so, you know, there's a limit to the extent to which the Democrats can even get people to recognize what's happening. But I think that, you know, we need to begin a drumbeat of getting people to realize, A, just how extraordinary, how unprecedented this behavior is, number one. And number two, get people to begin to reflect on what will America look like if this man is reelected in a way that everybody believes is just theft. You know, how does the nation hold itself together? Because I think, you know, the other side, my side, has been pretty patient after 2000 and 2016. Those were two elections that were ordinary. They happened to flip the result from the Democratic majority, but through ordinary process. We could argue about Bush v. Gore in Florida, but okay, we'll accept it. But the idea that this man would be reelected through means that people perceive as basically fraudulent or criminal and then expect to govern peacefully, I think is just crazy talk. And I'm terrified about what happens to our nation if we get to a place where that has happened and there's no effective remedy, because obviously Congress can't impeach the man. The partisan premise of Congress means there's no impeachment, at least depending on who controls the Senate. And that means that we're not going to have any opportunity to remedy what, you know, will be an astonishing moment in American history, the basic theft of an election.
Well, if we look at what we'll call the Black Lives Matters protests with George Floyd, he was not the first African-American whose life was taken at the hands of the police force. Yet there was an international conflagration of protests after that. Do we anticipate any protests either before or after the election spontaneously? Because as you said earlier, it depends on the public, serving the public. So does the public have to rise first and then pull the politicians along with them?
Well, I don't expect, unless there's some – well, I mean, let's be clear. There are scenarios where, yes, there would certainly be extraordinary protests in advance. So our Constitution, which is – as I said, extremely fragile here. According to the Supreme Court, plainly allows a state like Florida to declare that it's not going to have an election and it's just going to pick its electors how it wants. So Florida could declare before the election, at least, it's clear. After the election, it's not as clear. But before the election, the legislature could vote, well, we're not going to have a vote. We're just going to give the electors to the Republican Party. If states do something like that, I think you'll see tons of protests before the election. But if we go through and we try to have a real election and it seems like there have been games that have been played, or I don't know why we would call it games, if there's criminal corruption of the process of voting, and afterwards the consequence of that is that President Trump is reelected, I certainly think there will be extraordinary protests. Hell, I'll be out there with them because it is just not acceptable. And there's a certain moment at which you've got to stand up and fight for a democracy. And we've seen so much contrary to the norms of democratic order over the past 3 years that at some point we've got to say we can't accept it anymore and do whatever it takes to make sure that it doesn't have its effect.
For those who are not constitutional scholars, could you please walk slowly through the process of Florida or another state picking electors and essentially punting the election?
Well, the Constitution, of course, doesn't directly elect – I'd say that the president will be directly elected. What it says is that states get to appoint, in whatever manner they choose, electors. And their electors then vote for the president. So the states appoint the electors, or they set up the process to appoint the electors through state law. And if prior to an election, the state changes its law and says, you know, we originally thought there'd be an election, but now there won't be an election. We'll just pick a slate of Republican electors. The Supreme Court has said, most recently in Bush versus Gore, but before that 100 years ago in a case called McPherson versus Blacker, that the states retain the right, quote, at any time to recall the selection of electors and exercise that power themselves. Now, at the founding, there were many states that did exactly that. Many states didn't have elections. They just picked electors. Some states had elections. Some of those elections were by district. Others were at the state level like we have today. So there were lots of different systems originally. We've all converged now on the idea of the public having a say through a vote, but the Constitution doesn't say that it must have a say through a vote. And so if the state of Florida, governed by a Republican legislature and a Republican governor, comes to believe that the only way Donald Trump gets reelected is if Florida goes with Donald Trump, and the polls seem to suggest that it won't, I would not be at all surprised if they exercise this power to say that Florida doesn't get a vote. And I think what ought to be happening right now is that people ought to be clear about this possibility and demand that people like the governor of Florida or the people running the legislature in Florida answer the question, will you promise to have an election? Will you promise not to cancel the election? Because I think that there are so many scenarios where, you know, the pandemic recurs and there's all sorts of anxiety about – safety, and they say, well, we can't safely imagine people going out and voting, and so rather than risking their lives, we're going to cancel the election, and we know that this is a Republican state anyway, so we'll just give it to the Republican electors. There's so many ways they could get away with it. And so I think we right now need to start saying, okay, just be clear. Are you going to commit to an election? And are you going to commit not to cancel the election no matter what? Because, you know, we've run elections during wars. We've run elections during the Civil War. Lincoln was reelected in 1864. It was another year before the war was over. So we've done it before, and I think we need to be committed to doing it now. But the danger is that there could be a strong incentive for some states to flip if they're going to try to make sure Donald Trump gets reelected.
Okay, there was a recent Supreme Court case relative to the obligation of electors to vote according to the public will. Could you explain that case and the effect thereof?
Yeah, it's actually my case. So I was working with electors from the state of Washington, and my organization, Equal Citizens, had sort of teed up this case both in Washington and Colorado. Because in 2016, there was a question raised whether electors are free to cast their ballot however they wish. And we thought it was really important that the Supreme Court answer the question whether they have that freedom before it creates a constitutional crisis. So we teed up the case and we got electors in Washington state. These electors had been fined because they had voted contrary to their pledge in 2016. And then there was an elector in Colorado who had been kicked off. He cast his vote contrary to his pledge, and he was kicked off and replaced with another elector. And so the question we wanted the court to answer was whether by being given the power of a, quote, elector and told to cast, quote, their votes, they're allowed to vote however they want, or whether, as Justice Kagan put it, like a Soviet system, they had to vote as they were directed. Well, the answer of the Supreme Court was it's a Soviet system. They have to vote as they are directed. And that made a lot of people happy because they don't like the idea. And I understand at first glance why one would not like the idea that electors have this kind of discretion. I actually, by the end of the case, I argued the case in the Supreme Court, or I argued it by telephone from my office in the Supreme Court. But by the end of the my preparation for that case, I became pretty convinced that it was going to be a huge mistake if the Supreme Court said that electors didn't have discretion, because you can imagine that discretion being the final safety valve in this whole disaster of an election that we're seeing. But the way the court decided it, electors are basically pawns. They can't do anything except what they're directed by their state to do. And so if they're directed to vote one way, they're going to have to vote that way regardless.
And so what do you feel about the status today?
Well, I think that there are many ways in which this goes south. Here's just one. You know, imagine, God forbid, but imagine Joe Biden wins the popular vote but then passes away before the Electoral College votes. The 20th Amendment, passed in the 1930s, addresses the case where a candidate dies after the Electoral College votes but before he's sworn in as president. And they expressly thought to themselves, well, there's no reason for us to deal with the problem of a candidate dying before the Electoral College votes because the electors have a discretion. They can decide to vote however they want. And so if, you know, Joe Biden died, you would imagine all the electors would vote for Kamala Harris. But the Supreme Court's decision means they have to vote as they're directed to vote. And though the court said we're not actually addressing that case here, we're not addressing that question. If that scenario happens, there's going to be a fight. Because if they vote, if they're required to vote for Joe Biden, and then they vote for Joe Biden, Joe Biden's vote can't be counted because Joe Biden is not alive. So that means it would throw the election into the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives, under the Constitution, votes one vote per state. So you could have a clear majority of people voting for a Democrat, but depending on how the elections happen in 2020, you could have a majority of states that are Republican, state delegations that are Republican. So you could have the Democrat win the popular vote and would have won the Electoral College vote, but for the weird way that the votes get reallocated. But the way the system ultimately results is that the House of Representatives votes and the House of Representatives votes for the Republican. And again, I think most people would be astonished at that result, but that's plainly on one track in the way that this election might unpack.
What is the experience, whether it be live or over the phone, of arguing before the Supreme Court, certainly vis-a-vis some other lower court?
So it's pretty inferior compared to a lower court. I had two arguments in the last couple months, one in May and one in June, or one in July. One in the Supreme Court was in May, and one in a district court was in July. And the problem with the argument in the Supreme Court is that the Chief Justice set it up so every justice gets basically 2 minutes to ask questions. You know, that's less than a congressperson has. And so they come into their argument with a list of questions. They're not really listening to what other people have asked. They're not really interested in creating an understanding around the argument about the case. They're just interested in getting their particular questions asked. So it was a very unsatisfying experience because I felt like so much was being missed and every single answer you gave could be no more than 100 words, you know, no more than a minute because the chief would cut you off so that somebody else can ask a question. When I argued in the district court in California before Judge Chen, you know, it was just me and another guy and this Ted Olson, pretty significant lawyer, and the judge. You know, we probably went on for an hour and a half. The judge asked questions. He let us answer them as long as it took to answer them. He probed the questions. He really understood by the end our argument, whether he agreed with it or not is a separate question. But the point is, it was an actually effective context for engaging in the question. And what's frustrating is, you know, the case that I was arguing in the district court involving a regulation involving cell phones, you know, we think it's important enough, but it's not the Constitution. And so the idea that you would end the argument and feel like the judge understands the question and can now decide for this cell phone issue, but the Supreme Court barely pierces the issue around the Constitution's Electoral College was ultimately incredibly unsatisfying. I've argued, you know, live in the Supreme Court. And the difference is when you argue live, there's no, you know, they don't go around one by one and say, what's your question, Justice Thomas? What's your question, Justice Ginsburg? They just basically, the person starts arguing and then people interrupt him or her and ask questions. And that dynamic actually builds a kind of arc of the argument. So you can, the questions build off each other. And by the end, the case has kind of been, you know, resolved. You kind of understand the strong points and the weak points on the basis of how people have engaged in the argument. Now, even then, I think the Supreme Court has been wildly too conservative in the amount of time that it gives people to engage with them. You know, and maybe, you know, there was a time when the court was deciding 150 cases a year. It's down now to like less than 80. So it's not, I don't understand why they can't give it more time. But in either context, it's not as great as it can be in the other contexts like lower courts.
And you get stage fright, or are you intimidated at all in arguing in front of the Supreme Court?
I don't think that I felt frightened. I don't feel that. I imagine, part of that is just I had the extraordinary experience of clerking at the court, and that was, you know, an honor and incredible fun. But it also was an experience that taught you just how human the justices were. And you realize these are not legal gods. And they're just trying to understand the case. And you're kind of helping them to understand the case. So it's not about being afraid of them. They're not going to, you know, evict you from the country or get you fired. It's just trying to figure out how you bring them to the right place. And that's always hard. It depends on the case. It can be extremely hard, especially when the result that you're arguing for would be a very difficult result for the court to give, given the political reaction to that. So, you know, our side was arguing electors were constitutionally free. And we thought that was an important position And we thought, you know, I would defend what the electors that I was representing did. There was a CNN documentary about them on Saturday night. And, you know, the basic story with these electors was that after they saw that the candidate they were going to vote for, Hillary Clinton, was not going to win, they tried to work with Republican electors to get enough of them to vote for someone other than Donald Trump so that the House of Representatives could then decide, should Donald Trump be the president or should another Republican be the president? Nobody imagined Hillary Clinton would be the president. So they were trying to exercise their discretion to bring about a result that was closer to what the people who had voted for them wanted than the election of Donald Trump would have been. But still, I think when people talk about these so-called faithless electors, that's how they're referred to, it kind of scares people to imagine electors having that kind of discretion. So if the court had ruled with us, you know, I would be suffering an extraordinary amount of hate from people all across the country saying, how could you do such a thing? Now Donald Trump can bribe these electors and they can vote however he wants them to vote. And all of that, I think, is just crazy talk, but it still would have been anxiety producing. And maybe anxiety is the last thing the world needs right now in the middle of this election.
Staying with the Supreme Court, the conservatives tend to go with an originalism interpretation of the Constitution. Give me your take on that.
So they want you to believe. But I don't think it's actually true that that principle constrains them. It's more a tool that they can deploy when it fits with what they think they have to say or what they want to say. You know, I've argued two cases in the Supreme Court where the originalist answer was pretty clear. The first case I argued was a case about whether Congress has the power to extend the terms of an existing copyright. So this was the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. Congress extended the term of copyrights in 1998 by 20 years. That was the 18th time they had extended the term of copyright in the prior 25 years. And so our claim was the Constitution says Congress has the power to set quote, limited times for copyright. And it makes no sense to say that every time that limit expires, they can extend it again and again and again. And we had tons of originalist argument to say the framers were very skeptical about the monopoly of a copyright and they would want it restricted. And I made that argument and I fully expected the conservatives would pipe up and say, yes, that's what the originalist position is. But they sat silent. And the five of them joined an opinion by Justice Ginsburg, who's not an originalist, so there's no complaint against her, which allowed Congress to do whatever the hell they wanted. And the same thing with this case. You know, the original understanding, you know, Justice Jackson, in an opinion in 1952, said no one faithful to our Constitution can deny that the framers contemplated what's implicit in the text, that electors would be free agents, free to cast their vote however they wanted. So an originalist would look at this and say, look, there's no doubt that's what they expected. Whether that's what we expect or whether we should continue to respect that is a separate question. But there's no doubt that's what they expected. And an originalist, I would have thought, would have taken that seriously. But once again, the originalists were silent. The opinion written by Justice Kagan is not – Justice Kagan's not an originalist. Justice Thomas wrote a concurrence. He agreed with one part of our argument. He added something else from left field. But there, too, he was not constrained by original understanding. So I still have faith that we'll get them to do the originalist thing when it's an important thing to do, even when it's not an important thing to do for conservatives, just an important thing to do for the Constitution. But I don't think it's fair to say that there are consistent originalists out there.
To what degree is the Federalist Society important and impacted the court system? Needless to say, the Republicans have played a long game over decades. They were a minority in the educational system. They invested money. They formed this organization. And then decades later, it seems to be paying off. So to what degree is that an effect? And to what degree is there a concomitant effort on the other side?
The Federalist Society has been the most successful influence organization in setting the direction of the federal judiciary ever. You know, it's begun in the early 1980s at Yale Law School. Stephen Calabresi and someone else, I'm blanking on the person's name, it might be Lee Lieberman, start the organization. And originally, you know, it started at the Yale Law School, which is a hotbed of liberalism. It started really as an intellectual balance, as an organization that tries to create an opportunity for conservatives to express their views in a context where mainly liberals were holding the court, the local law school court. And, you know, I think from that perspective, what they were doing was perfectly fine. It was great because, of course, adding diversity to the intellectual environment of a law school is what we should all be aspiring to do. But over time, they developed very tight connections with the infrastructure for appointing judges. And they almost became a kind of clearinghouse. You know, the ABA is supposed to be a clearinghouse. The American Bar Association is supposed to vet judges and give their views thumbs up or thumbs down about qualifications. But the Federalist Society became an almost, a farm league or a feeding, a system for feeding a supply of judges to presidents, Republican presidents, keen to appoint more judges. So at the lower court, in the lower courts, district court and courts of appeals, they've been enormously important. And, this president has appointed an extraordinary number of judges. I think the number is something like 300. But the point is, Mitch McConnell views this as the one thing he knows he can get done. And he has bent over backwards to appoint as quickly as he can practically everybody who's come through. There's no filibuster check anymore that allows a minority to stop that type of appointment. And we've seen some extraordinary appointments. People which the ABA has said are plainly not qualified have been appointed nonetheless because they are perceived to be extremely loyal in a partisan sense at the lower court. And we'll see what the long-term effect of this will be. I'm not somebody who believes that a person who's a conservative is not qualified to be on the court or on any court. I clerked for Judge Posner, the Seventh Circuit. Judge Easterbrook was on the court at the same time. They were both Reagan appointees, extremely conservative. But two of the best legal minds in the history of America. So I think that there's, extremely talented people on the right, like there are talented people on the left. But I think that this effort to appoint reliable votes as opposed to talented conservative lawyers is a real mistake because it really dilutes the integrity of the judiciary. And we've already seen the beginnings of that. And I fear, these appointments of people who are in their 40s, 30s in some cases, is an act that's going to have an effect for the next 30 years, next 40 years.
Well, other than railing against this and being aware of it, certainly under Trump's reign, is the other side doing anything? Are they organized to combat this effort by the right?
I don't think that they're organized in the same way. There's a parallel organization called ACS, the American Constitution Society, which runs liberal directed conversations on law school campuses, but they've not tried to build the same kind of recruiting infrastructure. I mean, you could call the head of the ACS, and the head of the ACS, I'm sure, will have people to recommend. But it's not like the business model. If there's a Democratic president elected and there's Democratic control of the Senate, I expect there'll be a lot of Democratic judges or judges appointed by the Democratic Party who I will say, maybe this is just stupid blindness or ignorance or bias on my part. I will say they are not going to be people who the ABA says are not qualified. They might be young people. I hope they're young people. But they're not going to be the kind of people that Mitch McConnell has affected, and that's a good thing.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance. Helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change, so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Have you made the switch to Knix? Millions of women have made the switch to the revolutionary period underwear from Knix. That's K-N-I-X. Period panties from Knix are like no other, making them the number one leak-proof underwear brand in North America. They're comfy, stylish, and absorbent, perfect for period protection from your lightest to your heaviest days. They look, feel, and machine wash just like regular underwear, but feature incognito protection that has you covered. You can shop sizes from extra small to 4XL. Choose from all kinds of colors, prints, and different styles, from bikinis to boy shorts, thongs to high-rise. You've got to try Knix. See why millions are ditching disposable, wasteful period products and have switched to Knix. Go to knix.com and get 15% off with promo code TRY15. That's knix.com, promo code TRY15 for 15% off life-changing period underwear. That's knix.com.
Okay, let's switch to an earlier point, which is the silos that people receive their information in. Needless to say, in a three-network world, we have the fairness doctrine. If we ultimately go all the way to Sinclair Broadcasting, there used to be a limit of the number of television stations you could own. However, on the other side, there's social media. There's Facebook, there's Twitter, Snapchat, and the other outlets that there was just yesterday in the newspaper that Facebook increases the views of Holocaust deniers. So what do we do with A, the raw issue of people not being informed, and B, to what degree do these outlets contribute to it, and what can we do about that?
This is the worst and hardest problem. So first, we have to identify the source of the problem. And the source of the problem is not technology in the abstract. The source of the problem is the business model of the technology platforms as well as television stations. You know, when there were three networks, the business model of news, which, remember, was coordinated. It's exactly the same time news came on all three networks. So, you know, you're watching TV, you're going to watch the news. And the business model of those news stations was to shoot right down the middle. It was a very kind of plain vanilla approach, tell the story in the way that was the most inclusive possible. I'm not saying it was unbiased in some absolute sense. I'm not saying it was comprehensive. There are certain issues that never got covered. There's all sorts of ways you could criticize it. But what you couldn't say is that it was trying to create tribes in America. It, you know, Walter Cronkite thought that what he was doing was speaking to America, and he wanted to tell the truth to America. And the consequence of that was a kind of understanding, a common understanding that was shared by almost everybody, because that's all there was. Those three networks, and at that time every day, news was being covered. But once networks were no longer the center of television, once cable television came along, and you weren't forced to watch one of three channels, you could watch one of 120 channels, then the news needed to compete. You know, news had to compete with Home Shopping or with ESPN. And so it needed to find a way to bring people to it. And the critical business model innovation was Roger Ailes at Fox News. You know, when Fox, Rupert Murdoch brought Roger Ailes in and he pitches to Fox News how he imagines running Fox News, he startles everybody by saying that he's not going to try to pitch the story to all of America. He's going to focus on what he called the base. He's going to build a network focused on the base of conservatives. And by doing that, he would build a loyal and coherent public, which it would be easier to sell advertising to. And so the idea of the business model focused on a fraction of America is the critical change in cable television. And initially, only he is doing that. But now, you know, if you look at the ideological content of the three major cable networks, they're perfectly separated. You have Fox far to the, well, not in an absolute sense, but relative to, Fox far to the right, MSNBC to the left, and CNN kind of bouncing in between. And that's a business model decision. And the consequence of that business model decision is that people who get their information from television increasingly come to believe the world is different from people who get their information from a different channel on television. Barack Obama says if you watch Fox News, you live in a different planet than if you read the New York Times. And so that consequence of this separated tribal world is a consequence of the business model of cable television. And it's the same thing with the digital platforms. You know, Facebook is a platform for selling ads. That's where they make their money. I mean, they, you know, gussy it up by pretending that it's all about community and all about enabling people to share and connect and blah, blah, blah. But the thing it sells Wall Street, the reason why its stock is valuable, is that it's an extraordinary machine for selling ads. But the way that it sells ads is to figure out everything it can about you so that it knows exactly what will work with you and so that it can promise advertisers a higher return from their ads than anybody else. And the way it does that is it spies on you. It spies, watches everything you're interested in doing, shows where you're going, who you're talking to, what kind of things you're interested in. And then after spying, it pokes you. It tries to make you angry or happy, and it sees how you respond. It's a constant experiment to develop a really sophisticated model of you so that it can sell ads. And the unfortunate thing for democracy is that it turns out fueling this politics of hate is a really effective way to learn things about you. If we can, like, hold up the kind of red meat or, to kind of inspire you to get angry, you'll engage more, you'll share more, you'll be more responsive to what is coming across your newsfeed. And the more responsive you are, the more they know. And the more they know, the better their ads are. And so, once again, it is the business model of the platform that is driving them to engage with our political environment in a way that weakens our capacity as a democracy to do what we need to do in the context of an election, which is to come to a judgment about which candidate or which party is actually in the best interest of America. And in both cases, you can imagine a different business model. You can imagine a different way of, like, deploying the technologies. But unfortunately, we've backed ourselves into the worst possible pair of business models. And the consequence of that is these platforms are not contributing to a better democracy. They're contributing to a more polarized, more tribalistic, less capable democracy than any we've had since the Civil War.
Now, the ship really has sailed on broadcast television. The ratings, the actual number of people watching these news channels is astoundingly low despite the press. The younger generation is finding their information online. So focusing on that, you know, at Twitter, they say they're not going to have any political ads at all in this cycle. Is there any way to address the problem you just delineated?
Well, you know, there's this great health movement called the slow food movement. And what the slow food movement says is the only way to respond to the terrible way people eat is to look at how the human body works and fit your consumption to the human body. And so it turns out that if you cook your own food and you eat it over a long period of time, like over dinner with friends, you know, 2 or 3 hour dinner, that way of consuming food will be the healthiest for you. Like, you can't poison yourself the way you do with processed food. And you'll eat the right amounts and you'll eat it at a pace that will actually complement the process in the body. So the slow food movement is about finding the way to eat that fits our physiology. There's an equivalence, we could call it the slow democracy movement. And so the slow democracy movement, like the slow food movement, says, you know, we do democracy well in some contexts and we do it poorly in other contexts. So we do it poorly in a kind of Facebook or Twitter environment. Like, we get riled up. We you know, act on the basis of a tiny bit of information. We're easily misled. We're easily guided into the wrong understanding of the facts. We're just not good. We're not good in that environment. But there are environments where we are pretty good. So, you know, my favorite is an environment like this, a podcast, where people have a chance over a long period of time to hear the arc or the development of a story or an argument. They understand and they have a chance to reflect on it the way, you know, humans have that understanding in their ordinary interaction with ordinary people. And that in the context of that type of engagement, they learn about issues in a better, more comprehensive way than they would ever over Twitter or over their newsfeed on Facebook. Or, you know, narrative content like television shows that are, you know, that are not documentaries necessarily, but that try to tell a moral story or tell a story about some historical moments that gives you a chance to imagine and envision and see played out the tensions of the, you know, moral issues or the struggles. You know, my favorite, even though there's a million reasons to criticize the series, but like Homeland, which over the arc of its 6 or 7 series, you know, brought an incredible number of Americans to a different, deeper understanding of the story of the Middle East than they had when that series began, which was, you know, this kind of simple black-white, good versus bad picture of the Middle East. I think what the solution is for us to find ways to channel more of politics into context that we have a good reason to believe humans can process well. You know, some people's response is to say, well, get humans out of the mix. Like, let's just have experts. Like, forget democracy. Let's just have a technocracy where, you know, the smartest people, you know, Harvard law professors get to decide everything. And, you know, having known a bunch of Harvard law professors, I can tell you that would be a disaster. It'd be the worst thing in the world to imagine turning these decisions over to the elite of America. But instead of, like, giving up on democracy, I think we have to find a way to make democracy work by giving people a chance to understand and engage on issues in a way that we know they can actually process. And so that means channeling away from the 5-second ad or the 30-second ad on television or the Facebook feed or Twitter into places where they actually have a sense of what the issues are and they can get a real sense of the people involved.
But how does that address the silo issue?
Well, we don't have the ability, given the First Amendment, to address it through legislation. So we're not going to blow up the silos. They're going to exist until they're no longer profitable. So the way to deal with the silos issue is just to give people a different sense of what they want to do, what they want to consume. And then they consume differently, maybe, hopefully. You know, that's the same fight in the kind of healthy food movement. Like, you know, if all this unhealthy food, how are you going to deal with it? You can't ban it. I mean, you know, Michael Bloomberg thought you could basically do that with sodas in New York, but you're not going to across the country ban it. The most you can do is get people to reflect on, like, what's the actually healthy way to eat? Like, what sort of things should you be eating? And let's develop the right sensibilities of how we should be eating and what balance we should have and practice that. Take responsibility, you know, both for your diet of food and your diet of information. Be a responsible consumer in both dimensions. Now, I say that, and I'll be the first to say, I'm not optimistic. You know, I think that we're at a moment that we literally have never been in before, a moment like this. I mean, people, historians will say the media 100 years ago was just as fragmented, just as polarized as it is today. And they're right, it was. But the difference is 100 years ago, there was no way to know what the public thought. There was no polling. So you could have a public that was partisan and divided and lived in their own little echo chambers. But actually, the people who made policy were politicians in Washington. And they understood both sides of the issue. And they were engaged in real debate and deliberation about what they should be doing. And they did what they did and kind of what the people thought was irrelevant. We live in a time where the public is polarized and divided, the press is completely partisan and drives people in their own little silos, but we can see what the people believe. And so you can always point back to what the people believe as a justification for whatever crazy thing you want to do. So 74% of Americans think we need to invade Iraq, you know, based on misrepresentations and falsehoods and ignorance about the actual facts. But that's what America says, so that's what we have to do. And so I think the problem is that we both have a system for understanding what the people believe, but don't have a system for giving people the chance to believe what they actually would believe if they understood the facts and had a chance to reflect on them and deliberate about them.
Okay, so you were essentially saying there's no place for the legal system to address these problems in social networks?
Not in America, not right now. Because any effort to directly affect the content of these networks is going to be resisted by claims of the First Amendment. I mean, there are things to do on the margin. You know, I think that the legal system, you know, this Donald Trump has sent something close to this, and I don't want to sound like I'm mimicking what he said because I think it's importantly different. But I do think that we can think more, we can think in a smarter way about how to make platforms responsible so that they don't allow misrepresentations to propagate in a way that can be destructive. Right now, the legal system basically gives them total immunity for defamation or false information that they are allowed to spread. And of course, when the business model is as it is, where you have a strong interest to spread false information for political reasons or even just for advertising reasons, that creates a really dangerous incentive. So I think the legal system could, on the margin, tweak that and do that better. But I don't think that the core problem with the business model is going to go away because of fixing that. So then you want to say, well, can the legal system come in and, you know, ban advertising? And my view is I'd love to try. I'd love to say, let's see what happens if we ban political advertising for 6 weeks before an election. I mean, you know, it would be stupid to ban it all the time because, you know, advertising is good for selling products and products drive an economy. And it might not make sense to say ban advertising for, like, you know, the local state representatives, because that turns out to be a really efficient way for them to get their message out there. But where you've got these really polarized and potentially foreign influence-driven campaigns for president or for the control of Congress, I would love to see what happens if we just turn off the mechanism for tweaking or driving the public according to whatever interest the advertiser might have, and see what happens. I expect that you're going to see countries that try to do that, and we might learn something from those countries. And it would be great if what we learned is that's all it takes. Just turn off the advertising, and you know, it's not that social media becomes great, but it doesn't become the poison that it was in 2016 and that I think it's going to be in 2020.
Now, broad concept, do you or do you not believe social media, search networks, et cetera, should be liable for the content on their sites?
I don't think you can answer that simply. I think there are contexts in which they should be liable, yes. But they certainly should not be liable for everything, regardless of the context or the steps that they've taken to avoid that content being there. So I don't believe in the absolute immunity that exists right now. And I don't believe we should go to a world where they're liable for everything that I upload onto a network. You know, it's got to be a more sophisticated kind of notice and takedown infrastructure than the copyright notice and takedown infrastructure is. I mean, you know, I mean, let's be realistic. So I mean, let's be real about this. It's not like networks are immune from every bit of content that's up there that might violate the law. I mean, they can defame someone and they're, you know, they're scot-free, or they can allow defamation on their network and they're scot-free. But, you know, if they allow a Disney movie to be distributed on their network in violation of copyright, they're not scot-free. They're going to be responsible if they don't take steps to take that down. So we've already decided that some content is important for us to regulate to make sure that the legal principles are upheld. And I think we could do more to worry about at least defamation and you know, have a broader concept of direct manipulation, you know, in the way that fake videos events that is for the purpose of misrepresenting or for creating dissent where the actual facts don't support it. How you do it is going to be so hard. I don't imagine as a simple statement here or a simple rule, but I do think we shouldn't give up on it because I think the consequence of giving up has already proven itself to be really devastating.
Let's address antitrust, okay? Generally speaking, the Republicans have been looser than the Democrats on this. We've had a number of very interesting things. We had the e-books case. The end result was that books became more expensive. We had the T-Mobile Sprint thing where people on the left said, we must have these more competitors, whereas anyone who was a student of the business said, hey, Sprint is going to go out of business. They're going to go bankrupt. Then we have people like Elizabeth Warren saying, let's break up the social networks. What are your viewpoints about antitrust and what should the decisions be made upon?
Well, I think we should recognize that we've basically had no antitrust enforcement in the technology sector in any significant way since the Microsoft decision 20 years ago. And I think that's been a mistake. I think we've allowed these companies to get much bigger than they would have gotten had ordinary principles of antitrust been deployed consistently throughout the period. And I wouldn't blame Republicans for that. I mean, certainly I blame Republicans for what happened under George Bush, but I blame Democrats for what happened under Barack Obama and the clearest moments when antitrust should have stepped in was under Barack Obama. And now we know from, Mark Zuckerberg's email that their intent, that their game was exactly this kind of anti-competitive acquisition strategy. And I think there's a real reason to be worried about that. And I think that the reason to be worried about it is much more than just a pure economic reason, right? The standard Chicago school theory of antitrust is only worry about it if there's going to be a harm to consumers. But I think you also need to be worried about it because it creates these entities that are so powerful that they cannot be regulated. And so Luigi Zingales calls the political antitrust, which is a concern for the size and power of organizations, not just because of the economy, but also because of the political democracy. And I think from that perspective, we've plainly lost control of Amazon and Google and Facebook. These are entities which I as much as Elizabeth Warren was, inspirational in her aspiration, I think it was kind of crazy talk to imagine the government was going to be able to do any of the things she was talking about, given the enormous power that they have because they're plugged into everybody's lives directly.
Okay, let's talk about you for a second. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in the kind of Kentucky part of Pennsylvania, a town called Williamsport, Pennsylvania, which is about 80.
Little League World Series.
Exactly right. So about 80 miles north of Harrisburg. And I, was there from about the age of 6 until I went to college.
Okay. And what were the political leanings of your family?
So I grew up a Republican. I was quite an active Republican when I was a kid. I was chairman of the Pennsylvania Teenage Republicans. I was the youngest member of a delegation to the 1980 Republican Convention. We were strong conservatives back then.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
My father ran a steel fabricating company, his own company, steel fabricator. It's called Williamsport Fabricators. It was acquired by a company called High Steel Structures. And my mom, for at least the time I was in high school, was sold real estate, but she basically did that as a hobby.
And how many kids in the family?
So I had two older siblings and one who are about 9 and 10 years older, and then one younger sister who's 2 years younger than I am.
And the older siblings, what sex are they?
A boy and a girl.
Boy and a girl. So on some level, you were in the middle, but because of so many years in between, to what degree were your parents very supportive? Were you lost in the shuffle? Where were you in the hierarchy of the family?
Yeah, you're right. So my older siblings are basically gone when I, can actually remember anything about my life. And so I think that they were extremely supportive. I actually went away to school for a couple of years, 4 years, and
That was a significant.
Where did you go to school?
I went to it was called the Columbus Boy Choir, so it was a professional boy choir in Princeton from 6th to 9th grade.
And that was, it says choir, was it musically oriented?
It was a professional boy choir. We traveled around the world and we sang.
Whoa, 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 whoa. How did you even get into that?
You know, I was singing in my church choir and my choir director said, you know, you do this pretty well. You should try out for this boy choir. So I tried out and they told me I should come. And that started in 6th grade. And that was like a big chunk of my youth.
And good experience or bad experience?
So you tripped into this question, Bob. There's been an article written about this that's not announcing anything new. In some ways, it was the best of times. In some ways, the worst of times. It was the best of times because, you know, I was a kid from a small town traveling around the world understanding things that no one at my age would have understood. It was the worst of times because for 2.5 of those 4 years, I was sexually abused by the director of the choir. It had a profound impact on everything that happened afterwards kind of in my mind defines what the experience was for me. So I don't know. It depends which day I'm thinking about it.
Okay. Does one ever get over sexual abuse of that nature? Can you metabolize it? Does it affect future choices and experiences?
You never get over it. It's never gone. And some people, it's profoundly significant in everything they do. You know, some people, it probably drives them into their own kind of perversion. Some people, it creates an extraordinary insecurity or pathology around the ability to connect to people. I think very few people have a really clear sense of just how destructive mucking about with those emotions of a young child can be. I would say, you know, at the shrink level, there's never been a moment that I haven't been affected by it. At the professional level, I kind of think of most of my professional career as in some sense responsive to the problem that I was obsessed with when I was there. So that problem was, you know, what struck me about that experience was that, of course, there was this criminal at the center, who was pathological and just, you know, in some sense couldn't stop himself. And I wasn't the only person he abused. He was probably, depending on the year, could have been abusing up to 40% of the school. I mean, he was just, you know, he was insatiable and unstoppable. But the more striking thing to me was to reflect on the people who were around him and in some sense knew, but didn't want to step up and stop what was happening. Either because they turned a blind eye or because they thought it would be destructive of the institution or whatever the reason is, they were the enablers. And I kind of feel like if you really understood the thread of the work that I've done from the very beginning of my career, it has always been to try to draw attention to the institution or the context of the enablers and to ask, like the last work I did when I was running the Edmund Safra Center was focused on what we called institutional corruption. And that's the corruption not of criminals. It's not the quid pro quo corruption. It's the corruption of the institution where people, good people in the institution, allow the institution to become sensitive to or responsive to the wrong kind of desires or interests. So when Congress raises money to fund its campaigns, there's very little bribery involved in that. So it's not criminal in the traditional sense, but it's producing an institution that is not responsive to the ordinary people. And it's allowed to be that way because people enable it and support it. And they're not willing to step up and just say, this is wrong and we have to change it. And so I feel like everything I've done in some sense has recurred to that same reflection in, you know, very many different legal contexts. But all of that, you know, comes from moments reflecting on what happened to me when I was, you know, 12 and 13 and 14.
Now, did you age out of that situation or did you decide to leave?
I aged out. You know, your voice changes and you're gone. So my voice changed and I was gone.
Okay. Did this affect your relationships with women and girls thereafter?
Of course. Of course. You know, not, I mean, I'm happily married to an extraordinary woman, and I know other people who had the same experience who are not. So, I feel, but for the grace of God, there goes I. But, you know, in ways we've gone far in this conversation, far further than I think either of us thought we would. I don't want to go into the depth or the detail of it, but yes, absolutely. Day to day, that hung right in the middle of everything.
Okay, so you age out, your voice changes, you go back to public high school?
Yep.
What is that experience like after being away for 3 years?
It was difficult. People didn't quite understand who, you know, what the experience had been. Obviously, I didn't tell people what the experience had been, but it really affected how I understood the world. I kind of thought sex was at the center of everything, because sex was at the center of everything when I was 12. So I interpreted everything around me as if somehow sex was involved in it. So I remember this extraordinary moment of our neighbor came across the street and to tell me that her daughter had just gotten a car and a bunch of guys had, cleaned the car for her and tuned it up. And the way my mind worked, given the experience I'd had, I imagined, that sex had to be in that transaction somewhere. Like, that's just the normal thing. It would have been there. And I said something that reflected that, and she kind of was astonished. And I think back on it, and even I'm astonished. It's like completely abnormal way to think about the world, but, that's where I had been delivered. I was delivered thinking that's the normal way people interacted, because that had been the normal way I had seen for, many years of my life at that point.
So you're in high school. You fit in. You're a nerd. Where do you fit in the social structure?
Total nerd. Total nerd. You know, I'm in the bands. I run, I'm like a leader in student government. I'm a smart kid. I'm not the number one, but the number two. And, and I have a lot of good friends. But the hierarchy of high school, I'm not the football player or I'm not the coolest kids in the room. And I'm obsessed with obeying the law. So I don't drink and I don't, go out and drive at times I shouldn't be. And in that sense, yes, absolutely a nerd.
Oh, where does that come from, the sense that you have to must toe the line legally?
That's totally my dad. My dad was an obsessive in a good sense, just, completely absolute integrity sort of person. The thing I think about all the time with my dad is like, in college I worked in his firm. In high school I basically worked as a laborer, doing work, drilling holes in steel. But after college I did a summer where I was helping their finance department, negotiate a merger and transition. And the way they did business is they would bid jobs, basically usually to the state. They would give a price. They would get the job. And there was one job where the bidder forgot to include the bolts. So that was $1 million. And anybody would have at that stage, done everything they could to get out of the contract. Because $1 million is $1 million. That was basically the net worth of the company right there. And I suggested to my dad, well, what are we going to do? We got to get out of this. We can't go through with it. We can't spend $1 million because of this mistake. And he said, my word's my word. That's it. We're not going to get out of it. We're going to find a way to make it work. And, it's easy for a parent to talk about the right thing to do, but the greatest opportunity is to be able to teach by showing somebody that you're doing the right thing when it really hurts. And he did that all the time. And so that was what made me think about how I should behave too. And, I just couldn't break the law.
And did he get that contract?
He got the contract. He sucked it up. I think they were able to cut back about half of that loss, but it was a huge hit on the company.
Okay, so how do you decide to go to Penn and what's your experience there?
I was a legacy. My father, my grandfather, my aunt, everybody went to Penn. I did early admit. I got in, and so I decided to go. I went originally thinking I was going to be a businessman like my dad. So I went to the Wharton Business School, and as quickly as I could, I finished my degree there and got into the – I was interested in the history of economics, and then I left after I finished Penn with a degree from the college as well as the business school. I went to Cambridge to study philosophy.
Well, what was the inspiration? I mean, because you've had a long peripatetic career in education. You just said, okay, I want to explore more. There was no issue of going into the business world or anything.
Yeah, I mean, when I decided I didn't want to be in the business, I then thought I'd go to law school. And then, so I applied to law school and I got into law school. And then at the last minute, I thought, I just don't want to go to law school yet. So I was really obsessed with this philosophy course that I had taken in my last term at Penn. And I, you know, was searching around for how I could then do something else related to philosophy. And I thought I'd go to England. And I looked at Oxford, and it required a 30-page essay to apply. And I looked at Cambridge, and it required a 600-word essay to apply. So obviously, I applied to Cambridge. And I got in, and I went, and I spent 3 years studying philosophy at Cambridge.
And did you end up with a degree?
Yeah, I got what would become a master's. They have this weird way that what was an originally undergraduate degree matures into a master's. So I have a master's in philosophy. And I thought I would become a philosopher. I thought I would get a PhD. But then at the end, I just felt it was too remote, too removed from the real world. So I came back to law school.
Okay. But what did you learn from that experience in the UK other than socially?
You know, I think the really important part of education, part of growing up, is to place yourself in radically different contexts. Now, England is not radically different from America, but in many ways it was. And so that makes you much more sensitive to what in the background is making the world the way it seems and what is the part you're responsible for. So I loved my time in England. It was extraordinary luxury because I just got to read and write, and I had already had a degree, so I felt like I knew something. It was a long time ago. It was 83 to 86. That was a period when, you know, Margaret Thatcher was the prime minister. They were having these massive coal strikes. There was strikes of the students because she was trying to cut back the welfare subsidy to students. So there was a lot of social unrest in the country at the time. I felt it was, you know, the period where I could go deepest and think deepest about stuff that was important.
Okay, so you go to Yale. What's your experience at Yale Law School?
Well, first I actually went to Chicago and I transferred to Yale to follow a girlfriend who I'd met in England who wanted to go to Yale. So I spent my first year at Chicago.
That begs the question, what's the difference between going to the University of Chicago and going to Yale for law school?
They're radically different places. So Chicago I'm sure it still is. I don't have a clear sense of it today, but it's a great law school. Really super kids, really, really super professors. I mean, Richard Posner, Michael McConnell, Cass Sunstein, Jeffrey Stone. I mean, there was an incredible mix of people there. Diane Wood, who eventually also became a judge with Richard Posner. And so it was an intense, really intense legal education. Yale was more like a graduate school education. So, they're super smart kids. But they almost didn't take the law seriously. They didn't want to get deep into the messiness of the law. So I felt like in some ways it was the perfect education because I got a really deep legal education in my first year from the Chicago, and then I went to Yale and I could be more reflective and philosophical about it. And, you know, given I decided I wanted to be a professor, that was a pretty good chance to be in that environment for that.
Okay, what happened to the girl?
We were very serious for many years, but in the end it didn't work.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high-five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Have you made the switch to Knix? Millions of women have made the switch to the revolutionary period underwear from Knix. That's K-N-I-X. Period panties from Knix are like no other, making them the number one leak-proof underwear brand in North America. They're comfy, stylish, and absorbent, perfect for period protection from your lightest to your heaviest days. They look, feel, and machine wash just like regular underwear, but feature incognito protection that has you covered. You can shop sizes from extra small to 4XL. Choose from all kinds of colors, prints, and different styles, from bikinis to boy shorts, thongs to high-rise. You've got to try Knix. See why millions are ditching disposable, wasteful period products and have switched to Knix. Go to knix.com and get 15% off with promo code TRY15. That's Knix.com, promo code TRY15 for 15% off life-changing period underwear. That's KNIX.com.
Okay, how did you decide you wanted to be a professor?
You know, I realized I didn't have the discipline to work on problems I didn't find interesting. So I clerked at a law firm, Cravath, Swain & Moore, my first summer, and my second summer, and I saw all these people working on things that, you know, just seemed incredibly boring. And what struck me was not that they were incredibly boring. It was just, my God, how can you actually do that? Like, because I realized that if you told me I had to work on something that I didn't find interesting, I just physically couldn't do it. So I realized I needed a career where I was free to pick whatever I wanted to work on based on what I wanted to work on. And, you know, being – I wasn't rich, so being an academic was the best way to do that. And that's the freedom that the job gives me, and I've depended on that deeply in the years since.
And how did you end up at Stanford, and how did you end up at Harvard, and what are the differences between those two gigs and environments?
So after I clerked for Posner first at the Seventh Circuit and then Justice Scalia at the Supreme Court. I went back to Chicago, and I taught at Chicago for 6 years. And then I came to Harvard to start the Center for Internet and Society that was here. And then in 2000, after I got married, my wife was really keen that we see California, so we went to Stanford. I was there for nine years. And then I came back to Harvard in 2009. So they're very different environments. I mean, Stanford is like Yale in the sense of being small and very intimate. Although, of course, at the time, 2000 to 2009, it was filled with people obsessed with Silicon Valley, at the heart of Silicon Valley. Harvard is huge, which I find wonderful because what that means is that there's always someone who is doing what you want to, you know, be interested in. So there's always students who are interested in the stuff you want to work on. There's always professors who are working in the area you want to work on. So it's like a city. It's like New York City compared to a village. But, you know, as long as you're comfortable in a city, it's ideal.
Going back to Scalia, you know, Republicans idolize him like they idolize Reagan, where those on the left certainly are not in favor of his decisions. Since he's deceased, was it hype? Was he really that intelligent? What's your take?
Well, I think we have to recognize Justice Scalia was a justice for many years. So I guess he goes to the court in 86 or 87, and obviously he dies in 2016. So that's a long career. I think he was a different justice at different stages of his career. So what inspired me the most about him you know, when you apply, at least when I applied to be a clerk, you apply to everybody. And if you don't get a job from anybody. So you're not allowed to pick and choose based on, you know, the philosophy or the partisan character of a particular judge. But I applied and he interviewed me quickly and he hired me quickly. But what I admired about him is that, you know, he was someone who was deeply committed to live out his philosophy of originalism and textualism. And there were a number of cases, number of times when there was a case where the conservative thing to do was not necessarily the originalist thing to do. And in every one of those cases, I won't say that he was immediately convinced of the originalist thing, but in every one of those cases, he was eventually brought around to doing the originalist thing, even though it was against his otherwise conservative politics. And so I was impressed that at that stage of his career, at least, the principle of that he was advancing, he allowed to constrain himself. And part of, you know, that was he's just trying to work it out. Part of it was his belief that the principles were not didn't have a political valence to them. Part of it was he hired liberal clerks. I mean, I was a token liberal hired by Justice Scalia. The other clerks were very conservative. You know, they were there was a deep skepticism about me early on, maybe all the way through. Later in his career, he stopped hiring liberals. I asked him once why. He said, well, you know, I figured everything out. I don't need anybody to argue with anymore. so, you know, I didn't spend my career studying the work of Justice Scalia, so I don't feel like I'm an expert in the late Scalia or the Scalia circa 2010. But the Scalia I knew was someone that I didn't agree with in, you know, vast majority of cases, but he's certainly someone I respected for what he was doing.
And how did you go from being a young Republican to the other end of the spectrum?
You know, in one sense, I don't think I've changed because I'm still libertarian in the sense that I think society's objective should be to give people the widest scope for liberty that they can. But what changed was recognizing how much society needed to contribute to that project. So creating the conditions within which liberty can exist becomes an extraordinary part of what society has to do and what government has to do for that. So that means creating conditions, including conditions of equality. And so the more you focus on how do you create those conditions, what education, what protection for rights, what enablement of opportunities, you know, it was obviously the Democratic Party that was more concerned about those issues than the Republicans, certainly the Republicans today. And going forward, you know, I think one of the most interesting debates that came out of this recent Democratic primary was Andrew Yang's push for universal basic income. And one way to understand the push for universal basic income is, again, related to this idea of enabling people to have the most meaningful liberty that they can have. There's a really great book called Bullshit Jobs, which is a wonderful account of how, you know, up to 40% of us have jobs that we think of as bullshit jobs, by which he means is defined to mean a job which is doing no good for you or for anybody else in the world. You just are doing it, but you can't imagine how it's helping anybody. And it's not that other people think it's not helping anybody. You know, like I might think that a parking ticket person is not helping anybody. It's that you yourself don't think that you're helping anybody, that you don't think the world's any better off because of that. I think about, you know, the luxury of having a life where every morning I get up and I think I'm going to work on exactly what I want to work on compared to somebody next to me who is doing a job where they're thinking this is just contributing nothing to the world. That contrast, I think is going to be increasingly important as we think, how do we build a world where more people have the freedom to have jobs where they feel like they're actually contributing something, they're doing something, that's meaningful at least to them. And what Andrew Yang was talking about was something that would create the conditions for making that possible. Like UBI would make it so, you know, you would have enough to live and then you could pick a job. Maybe you wouldn't be able to work 40 hours a week on that job, you know, only a couple hours a week, whether it's, you know, being an artist or, building things in the forest, whatever. But the point is you could be living in a way that was meaningful to you. And I think that would be extraordinary if we set that as an objective for society. How would we make it so everybody wakes up every morning with the same feeling that I do, that this is what they They're doing what they want to be doing, and they have a chance to do it. And, you know, in a certain sense, I think that's libertarian. That's about making sure society provides to people that opportunity for liberty, even though there's a hugely important role for the state in creating the conditions for that liberty.
And you say you have the ability to choose your projects at Harvard. What are you working on right now?
Well, about a dozen years ago, I announced I was going to give up my work on internet and copyright to take up the project of addressing what I was calling then institutional corruption, but basically this corruption of institutions like government. My obsession with trying to find a way to get a democracy that would be responsive to the public as opposed to responsive to the special interests of the funders of campaigns. So that's the project I've been working on for the last 12 years. And it's the project I'll be working on till we get it done, you know, at least for the next 10 years. That's kind of, I've set, 70 as a point where I want to step aside. So what I'm working on right now are projects that are trying to elevate and make salient these reforms, democratic reforms. And so we've got a bunch of things related to this election to try to tee this issue up. Got a bunch of projects related to the Electoral College, which we hope, will follow this election and give a real opportunity for reform of the Electoral College. And my real hope is that if Joe Biden is elected and Mitch McConnell, the dark lord of the Senate, is returned to Kentucky, that there's a chance that Congress will pass fundamental democratic reform in the first 100 days. Joe Biden has promised they will do it. Nancy Pelosi has already passed that reform in the House last year, and she's committed to passing it in 2021 if she has a majority in the House again. Chuck Schumer has promised to pass it in the Senate if he has a majority in the Senate. So we have a real chance for this reform to be enacted. And if it's enacted, I think it will be the most important thing that this administration could do. So I'm eager to continue to push to try to make sure that that happens.
So for those who are not following as closely as you are, what would be the elements of that push?
Well, in 2018, Nancy Pelosi passed something called HR1. And what was significant about that title is that it signaled that this needed to be the first thing that would be done. And that recognized that nothing else was possible until you passed this reform. And this reform includes, most importantly, changing the way congressional campaigns are funded. You know, right now, members of Congress spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time raising money, spending their time on the phone calling donors. And their donors are not the average American. Their donors are the tiniest fraction of the 1%. So they spend, some people most of their time sucking up to this tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% to get the money they need to run their campaigns or to get their party back into power. That is a deeply corrupting experience. And so the most important thing I think HR1 would do was to create a different way of funding campaigns that would liberate them from that project. And by liberating them, give them a chance to think about what their constituents want or what's in the interest of the country as opposed to what the funders of campaigns want. So that's number one. Number two, it would end partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts in the states. Number three, it would restore the Voting Rights Act so that states cannot exercise their power to suppress the votes. Its target is African Americans, but the main reason, I think, for this suppression is just partisan. Like, Republicans want to make it harder for Democrats to vote. And where Democrats have that opportunity, they want to do the same thing, too. But the point is, it's a corrupting inequality on the basis of partisan power that we've got to end, and HR1 would go a long way to that. And then it did a bunch of other things related to ethics in government, automatic voter registration, things just to make the democratic process work better. And I think that if we passed that bill, maybe a little bit better than that bill, more aggressive in the changing the way campaigns are funded, then there would be an extraordinary opportunity to get a democracy that cared more about what people want than it cared about what the lobbyists or the funders of campaigns want.
And sketching in the painting a little bit more, how would campaigns be funded?
So HR1 has two ideas. Its real emphasis is on a matching fund system. So this is the way New York City funds most of its campaigns. So a matching fund system says if you give a small amount, that gets matched up to 6 to 1 by the government, so that small contributions are much more valuable. And the theory is candidates would then be looking for more small contributions, which means they would be more responsive to people who are giving small contributions than to the small number of people who give large contributions now. The other idea, which is the part that I think is really exciting and has enormous potential, and something that the city of Seattle has adopted, is something called vouchers. So give every voter a voucher. Think of it as a packet of coupons that they can use to give to candidates to help them fund their campaigns. So if you're a candidate running for office, what you know is every single voter in your district has $100 in their pocket that they can give you to help fund your campaigns. And so you'd be raising money from ordinary people, not from the tiny fraction of the 1% who fund campaigns now. And if you do that, raise money from those people, then you're responsive to those people. And I think that has the enormous potential to change the sensibilities of Congress, to make them more focused on what ordinary people care about as opposed to these big funders. And I think that would be the absolutely most important change that could be done. And so now in this last presidential election, there was an enormous focus on democracy reform. Every single major candidate, including by the end, Joe Biden on the Democratic side and Bill Weld on the Republican side, promised within the first 100 days to pass fundamental democratic reform. And in the Democratic side, people like Andrew Yang and Kirsten Gillibrand and Bernie Sanders endorsed the idea of vouchers. Kirsten Gillibrand wanted to give people up to $600 in vouchers, $200 for every federal race. So $200 for Congress, $200 for the Senate, $200 for the president. Andrew Yang said $100. Bernie was never clear about how much money he was talking about. But they all recognized that if you could make it so that ordinary people were funding campaigns, you would have a Congress more focused on what ordinary people cared about, not on the billionaires, the millionaires who are funding through their PACs or their large contributions.
Now, this all sounds great on the surface, but as someone who has seen multiple election cycles, I'm reminded of the famous George Carlin routine where he says, "You can vote if it makes you feel good, but the owners of the country are not going to give up power. They are really going to control." And I look at, Bernie Sanders, who certainly spoke to the public and raised all his money from individual contributions, as opposed to Biden, as opposed to Kamala, who ultimately couldn't raise that much money. It's hard to have confidence. The theory sounds good, but especially taxes have been denigrated to the point where everyone thinks taxes are bad, even people on the left. It's hard to believe, as a result of income inequality, opportunities in education. You're also talking earlier about long-form discussion of problems and issues. I certainly grew up in the 60s when public schools had enough money to educate people how to think. They were not teaching to the test. And is the system inherently broken, or will these Band-Aids fix it, or is there an elite? The funny thing, of course, the elite to a great degree is on the left. People who have worked very hard and educated themselves to gain power, who have contempt for those who work with their hands or in service positions. Are these really solvable issues under the present system?
They are solvable. And I think the kind of changes that I was just describing, for example, if you followed Kirsten Gillibrand's proposal and you gave everybody $600, $200 for federal race, that's not a Band-Aid. That would be a fundamental change in how Washington works. Now, I think it's a really important question whether the Democrats will carry through. Many skeptical, cynical people said that Nancy Pelosi was able to pass H.R. 1 in 2019 with every single Democrat voting for it because they all knew Mitch McConnell would kill it in the Senate. So it never was going to get passed. And these same people say that if the Democrats take control of the Senate, and they have control of the House, and they have the presidency, don't expect reform to pass, because then all the money in the world will be against reform passing, and they will stop the Democrats from passing. And I think that's a fair challenge. And it's up to us to make them do it. It's up to us to say, we have finally come to the point where the vast majority of Americans realize if we don't fix this corrupted, broken political system, nothing happens. Nothing happens. You know, you mentioned at the opening that I tried to run in 2016 for president. And my campaign in 2016 was expressly focused, exclusively focused on passing fundamental reform. And it was almost impossible to be able to run that campaign, you know, this complicated game that they played to change the rules to keep me off the debate stage, partly because the issue was not salient 4 years ago. But now, every single candidate endorsed this idea of fundamental reform in the first 100 days of the administration. So I think the Democrats have said they will do it. I think there's a chance we get enough Democrats in Congress to actually do it. And then we've got to hold their feet to the fire. And if they don't do it, then God help them. There will be a revolution. And I will be in the barracks, in the streets, doing everything I can to drive it. Because we can't get anything done in this country until we fix this problem. There's no climate change legislation that will pass until we fix this corrupted, broken system. There's no healthcare reform that doesn't benefit pharmaceutical companies or the insurance companies until we fix this corrupted, broken political system. Finally, people get that. And now the question is whether the Democrats will carry through if, in fact, they're able to stop this president from stealing the next election.
Let's just assume election day happens and the ultimate result is up for grabs. The obvious example being the year 2000. Many people believe in the year 2000s, despite having David Boies on the Gore team, that they were outmaneuvered by the Republican attorneys. If it's a jump ball, what should the Democrats do legally to ensure that they have the best chance of things coming out their way? There's so many issues. Who knows what the issues might ultimately be? But certainly there's issues of postmarks on absentee ballots, whether the ballots are filled out correctly. Then we certainly have people in charge of elections in states making unilateral decisions. And one can argue in previous situations, the Democrats or the opposing team, the Democrats, have been on their heels in this situation.
Well, it's absolutely true that this is going to be an incredibly complex election. I'm teaching a seminar in the fall called Wargaming 2020, which tries to map out all the things that can go wrong, all the places where the system can be played. So, you know, so if I were to advise the Democrats on what's the one thing they need to be doing in 2020 that they didn't do in 2000, they need to assume the other side is not going to play fair. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen. But I think one striking thing about 2000 was that so many times the Democrats were just astonished with what the Republicans did. I mean, even the core argument that actually in the end won, the argument about the Equal Protection Clause controlling or regulating how votes would be recounted, when that argument was made, people on the left said, this is just crazy talk. There's no way such an argument could work. But of course, it did work. And the Republicans were willing to do almost anything, including, you remember the kind of Brooks Brother riots in Florida, where you had these people who had been literally bussed in, who were pretending to be Florida voters, pounding on the doors, demanding that their hanging chad ballots be not counted or whatever, depending on the district. You know, and I think the Democrats were caught off guard because they just couldn't imagine that that kind of behavior would be engaged in. Well, I think now people are being woken up to recognize that this president will not stop at anything. Literally, he's got everything to lose, you know, not just the election. But given what we know about the, you know, criminal charges that are against his organization and his company, given what we know about the fiscal financial liability he faces to like Deutsche Bank, incredible amount of money outstanding, you can just see that he imagines that if he doesn't win, it's not just the election, it's also his whole empire collapses. And when you've got somebody against the wall and they know that everything disappears, if they don't win, they're going to do whatever they can. And I'm genuinely terrified about whether our legal system is capable of adjudicating when one side is operating in such bad faith. I just don't know. You know, we haven't seen good evidence that the court system will stand up to this so far. And what's to say that they will stand up, you know, against it in the context of that election? And And as I said at the very beginning, if that happens, I don't know what happens. You know, George Floyd brought out, I think it was something like 7% of America. It might have been 17. It's some number around there who turned out to protest because of that event. You know, take that, multiply it by 3 or 4, and you have a country destabilizing event. I don't know what the country is like if people, if there is an election which is stolen and people react in the way that I expect they'll react given the fury that this man has triggered across the country.
Now, you obviously have a singular high profile yourself, but to what degree are you integrated with the DNC or Kamala or Joe? Is that something where you have interaction with them? Is the lines open, or are you on your own separate island?
Well, I give advice on reform issues to anybody who wants it, and I've given advice to a wide range of people, including people involved in these campaigns. So I will continue to do that. I'm not inside the campaign in the sense of running anything, and I don't expect to be. Although, you know, my view is Joe Biden needs to become the president, and I will do whatever it takes to make whatever it takes that my father would approve of to make sure that that happens.
Larry, this has been unbelievable. We could go on for hours, but we're going to wear our ears out and those of the audience. But this has been incredibly edifying, especially to those people who don't follow the law on a week-by-week basis or even a year-by-year basis. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo!
Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again!
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five!
High Five!
Casino!
Casino!
Win at HighFiveCasino.com!
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.